This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In 2004, writings of Wallace Turnage and John Washington, two former slaves, came to light and to the attention of Yale historian David Blight. He used the material to learn more about the men. The resulting book, A Slave No More, contains their narratives of emancipation and the historian's account of their lives before and after the Civil War. The stories Washington and Turnage set down on paper are remarkable. David Blight says they are, in his words, they illuminate, rather, anew one of the greatest dramas of the Civil War, the anguished and glorious liberation of 4 million American slaves from generations of bondage. He also says their accounts are, quote, both unique and representative. They remind us that history is unpredictable, anguished, and hidden, but also sometimes patterned, triumphant, and visible in the quiet and turbulent corners of the lives of real people. Those words come from the prologue of A Slave No More, two men who escaped to freedom, including their own narratives of emancipation. David Blight is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David Blight is a professor of American history and the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He is the author of four books and the editor of three. His book, Race and Reunion, The Civil War and American Memory, was honored with the Frederick Douglass Prize, the Lincoln Prize, and the Bancroft Prize. Professor Blight's latest book, A Slave No More, is published by Hartcourt. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Blight, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me on, Celeste.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And forgive me for stumbling over your wonderful words there in my
introduction. Oh, that's
okay. Well, tell us how the accounts of these two men, John Washington and Wallace Turnage, came to your attention.
Well, it's almost a historian's dream. They both were brought to me far more than I ever discovered them. The first, by John Washington, came to me via a literary agent in Boston, Massachusetts, whose name is Wendy Strothman. And she was working on behalf of the manuscript's owner. And the second, by Wallace Turnage, came to me in the same six-month period. This is part of what's almost miraculous about this. In the same six-month period in 2003, the second time I was invited to speak at the Greenwich, Connecticut Historical Society, and while there, its director, Deborah Mecki, said that her staff thought they had an authentic slave narrative. And I said something to the effect of, oh my goodness, another one. And I sat down with the two of these manuscripts. Both were roughly the same length. And I realized quickly what I had were two post-Civil War, post-emancipation autobiographies by former slaves telling largely the story of how each man had escaped from slavery in the midst of the chaos and the violence of the Civil War. So this is one of those rare moments when you end up writing a book that you never really planned to write because the material comes to you.
Yeah. Now, you say these narratives have allowed you to understand emancipation as never before. What new insights have been gained with the discovery of these two narratives?
Well, what these two narratives show us and what they showed me is in two quite different circumstances, one in 1862 in Virginia, John Washington, and the other, Wallace Turnage, in August of 1864 in Alabama. They allow us two windows, two distinctive windows into how emancipation actually happened to people on the ground in the South, again in the chaos of war. I'm not sure that either narrative has fundamentally changed my own interpretation of emancipation, but it took me to the real-life daily stories of American slaves and how they confronted the risks, the dangers, the terrors of the possibility of escape, and how through their own cunning and volition and to some extent good luck, they were able to achieve their freedom. And in the end, what these two narratives help me argue in this book is that this now 20 or 30-year-old argument that we've been having among historians, and part of the larger society has too, as to just who and what freed the slaves. Were they freed essentially by President Abraham Lincoln and the Union Army, or were they self-emancipated? Did they essentially free themselves? The answer to that question, as both of these narratives show, is both. Neither man would have attained his freedom when he did without the presence of the Union Army and the Union Navy and the ultimate power of the Emancipation Proclamation, but also neither man would have attained his freedom without his own bravery and volition.
Yeah, intelligence and faith and tenacity.
Exactly.
Would you describe for us the scene in Fredericksburg, Virginia, as John Washington recalled it in April of 1862?
It is the most dramatic turn in his narrative, and you can almost feel him on the page when you read it trying to capture that moment. He had been raised in Fredericksburg. He had been born there and bided his time. He was 22 years old by 1862 at the moment of his escape. And he chose his moment of escape at the first arrival of Union troops along the Rappahannock River in April 1862. He describes a scene where his mistress, his owner, Mrs. Tolliver, is literally packing up the china and the silver to evacuate the city on the following day. And they have this exchange to the effect, she says, "John, you'll be with us tomorrow." And he says, "Oh, yes, mistress, yes, mistress." And then almost literally the next scene, John is at this hotel where he's been hired out as a kind of hired out slave. And he describes how all the white guests and the white manager of the hotel are fleeing into the streets. And then he describes how the black workers, about a dozen of them, all go up to the roof of the hotel where they can see across the river and they can see what he calls the gleam of the Yankees' bayonets. And then John, who at that point was in effect almost like an assistant manager of this hotel, in spite of his slave status, he brings all these workers down into the kitchen of the hotel, and he pours a round of drinks, and he holds a toast. And according to his testimony, the toast was to the Yankees. And then he, in effect, instructs his fellow slaves, he says, to get out of there, but as he puts it, don't get too far from the Yankees. And then John simply walked about two blocks down to the river. He witnessed the formal official surrender of Fredericksburg. And then with one of his cousins, he walked about a mile upriver northward or westward. And he said he crossed the river at Ficklin's Mill, and the old stone ruins of that mill are still there. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly where he crossed. And he crossed the river. And he was officially freed, if you like, by members of the 30th New York Volunteers. He even names the Union captain. His name was Ladd, who he had this exchange with. And he slept that night in the camp of a Union regiment. That was John Washington's escape. And when he encountered these Union troops, by the way, he has this remarkable exchange. He's so light-skinned because his father was white. Some of these Yankee soldiers are surprised that he could be a slave because his skin was so light. And one of them actually asks him, "Would you like to be free?" And in Washington's text, he says, "My answer was, of course." And then John Washington spent the rest of that summer serving as, a camp servant, a mess cook, and even a guide on horseback for the Union armies all over Northern Virginia, right through August of 62, through the Second Manassas Campaign. And he dates the day of his arrival in Washington, D.C., his sort of final escape as part of the first wave of freedmen out of Virginia. He dates it as September 1st, 1862. And before the end of that year or the beginning of the next year, we found records that John will manage to assemble his newly married wife, Annie, their newborn child, his mother, and his 68-year-old grandmother in Washington. They all appear in a city directory report by 1865, living on 19th Street in Washington, D.C.
Well, as the Yankees approached Fredericksburg back in April of 1862, it was Good Friday. So it was quite an Easter for John Washington, wasn't it? What does he write about his first hours of emancipation? How does he describe it? Maybe you would share that with us.
Oh, I'd love to read that little section. This is the moment in the narrative where he's describing that first night of his freedom and what it felt like to him. And the text reads this way. A most memorable night that was to me. The soldiers assured me that I was now a free man and had nothing to do but to stay with them. They told me I could soon get a situation waiting on some of the officers. I had already been offered one or two and had determined to take one or the other as soon as I could go over and get my clothes and some $30 of my own. Before morning, I had begun to feel like I had truly escaped from the hand of the slave master, and with the help of God, I never would be a slave no more. I felt for the first time in my life that I could now claim every cent that I should work for as my own. I began now to feel that life had a new joy awaiting me. I might now go and come when I pleased. So I would remain with the army until I got enough money to travel further north. This was the first night of my freedom. It was Good Friday, indeed the best Friday that I had ever seen. That's John Washington remembering what was in effect his first night of freedom.
Yeah. How did he decide to go to D.C. and bring his family there?
Well, as I said, he was with the Union forces from April all through the summer of 1862. He actually ended up a mess cook for a general in the Union Army named Rufus King. And safety or security or real freedom at this point meant getting out of Virginia. And by fleeing into the federal capital of Washington, D.C., he no doubt thought he and his now young family might be able to attain a certain kind of security and safety. And indeed, that was the case once they were in Washington. However, it needs to be said, Washington, D.C. was a pretty miserable place in 1862 and 63. In fact, when he escapes into Washington in September, Washington was one gigantic field hospital. In the wake of Second Manassas, there were thousands of wounded all over Washington. In fact, he first worked in some of those hospitals and eventually even in a contraband camp for escaped slaves in and around Washington. And at first they had a terrible time finding any kind of housing. He does describe at the end of his narrative finally finding a room, in effect, to rent over in Georgetown later in the fall. But it's pretty clear that at first they basically were living in the streets. But John and Annie Washington would end up living in Washington, D.C. almost the rest of their lives until 1918, and they would raise five sons in the city, and they became part of the first generation of former slaves who formed the black working class population of Washington, D.C. There were, by the way, approximately 40 to 45,000 freedmen out of Maryland and Northern Virginia that took up residence in Washington in 1862 and 1863.
Now, John Washington would have no way of knowing this, but you provide this detail in the book. That summer of 1862, that autumn, President Lincoln was meeting with black leaders in the White House, and he was lecturing them that equality was impossible.
That's right.
What was that meeting like, and what were Lincoln's intentions at the time?
Well, this was, if anything, Abraham Lincoln's worst moment on race and slavery in the midst of the war. He'll have some much better moments after this. But he held a meeting with some local black ministers and leaders in Washington, which did not include Frederick Douglass, as some people sometimes say, in August of 62. And at that meeting, Abraham Lincoln lectured these, I believe there were five black leaders, local clergy. He lectured them. He asked them to join on a plan to be colonized to foreign countries, perhaps to Central America, or even, as they put it, back to Africa. They were not interested in that in the least, and they greeted his offer with essentially silence. It was also at that meeting that Lincoln said that true racial equality would never really be possible in America. Now, that meeting has, and what Lincoln said at that meeting, has been read in very different ways and interpreted in different ways by historians. We need to remember this is before the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. Some have argued that what Lincoln was really doing with that meeting, and then by publicizing his remarks to the black leaders, that he was really trying to condition public opinion for what was to come later, which was formal, official, real emancipation. I think we've got to realize here that events were unfolding fast, and Lincoln had no clear idea yet just when he would issue emancipation, or even if, because he was waiting, of course, for some kind of battlefield military success in order to do that, which he would get the following month from the Battle of Antietam in Maryland. But it's an ugly exchange, to be quite honest, and it happened right during these weeks. In fact, it happened the third week of August. It's right while John Washington is with the Union Army in Northern Virginia, and indeed he comes into Washington, D.C. shortly after that meeting had occurred. He, of course, did not know about it. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the ironies that I try to develop in the book, that at the same time the actual policies of the federal government from the Lincoln administration and through the Army are beginning to evolve in this tortured way, people like John Washington are simply freeing themselves. They're not really waiting to find out what the formal official declarations or policies are of the Union government.
Yeah. Well, what were the hopes and dreams and visions of someone like John Washington and the men who were meeting with President Lincoln in the White House? What did they hope for an outcome?
Oh, gosh, their hopes, for someone like John Washington, who's just escaped out of Fredericksburg with the Union armies and is trying to assemble his newborn child and his newlywed wife and his mother and so forth. His first initial urges and wishes are simply for safety, for security, for protection. And then his wish was, as he says at the very end of his narrative, to get a real job, to have some kind of livelihood. John Washington actually ends his narrative with this simple declarative sentence where he says, "I am working two jobs in Washington, D.C., one of them is on the wharves, the other is bottling liquor, and I make $1.25 a week." Mm-hmm. Those are his last words in the narrative. So in other words, my aim here is wages to feed my family, clothe them, and house them. That's his first wish or desire. The higher sense of liberty, of human rights, of the right to vote, of civil rights, and so forth, that would come from this over time with the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments at the end of the war and during Reconstruction were, of course, yet to come. This is an extremely fluid, frankly revolutionary moment, which is easy for us to forget today. I mean, Americans look back at the Civil War and they tend to see it vaguely as this time when the Union was saved and the slaves were freed, and then the country went on and just got better for it. Well, that's not the way history actually happens. On the ground, the contingencies were confusing. They were multiple. And this story could have gone many different ways, depending on what happened out there on the battlefield.
Historian David Blight is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation. The narratives are from John Washington and Wallace Turnage. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, now to Wallace Turnage and his memory of 1864.
Right.
He said it was death to go back, and it was death to stay there, and freedom was before me. He had run away four times before winning his freedom. The first time in 1860, he was just 14 years old.
That's right. That passage you just read from him, by the way, is one of the clearest, starkest descriptions of what a fugitive slave risked in running away from slavery, whether it was before the Civil War or in the midst of the Civil War, in any of the slave narratives. Wallace Turnage was born on a small tobacco farm in North Carolina. He, too, had a white father. He knew exactly who his father was. And he had a slave mother whose name was Courtney Hart. But he was sold at age 14 by his indebted owner to a Richmond, Virginia slave trader, whom he named Hector Davis, who was one of the largest slave traders in the United States. Wallace spent about 6 months living in Richmond in 1860. His job, if you like, was working in the slave auction house, preparing the slaves each day in what was called the dressing room, and then taking them out to the auction floor. And one day he was put in the auction and sold. He was sold to an Alabama cotton planter who came to Richmond twice a year to buy slaves. And most of Wallace Turnage's narrative is then, as you suggested, the story from 1860 to 64 of his five attempts to escape, the first four of which, all of which, by the way, were induced usually by a brutal beating or the threat of a beating. The first four attempts were into Mississippi from the fall of 1860 right on through into early 62, or late 62 and 63. He was always trying to escape northward into northern Mississippi and trying to get, at least in the last two of those escapes, trying to get to the Union Army, which controlled the whole northern tier of Mississippi by early 1862. And then his owner, who kept retrieving him and kept retrieving him in the chaos of war because Wallace was so valuable, finally got frustrated, and he took him down to Mobile, Alabama, and he sold him at the slave jail in Mobile in the spring of 1863. And then Turnage spent the next, about 14 months working as a domestic servant, a kind of jack-of-all-trades for a merchant in Mobile. And one day in early August of 1864, he crashed his master's carriage. He crashed it in the street. The carriage broke. His master was so angry after that that he took him to the slave jail and hired the jailer to give Wallace 30 lashes with a god-awful whip. And it was in the immediate aftermath of that, standing bloody in the slave jail in Mobile, as his master said to him, "Walk home," that Wallace simply decided to walk right out of Mobile, and that's what he did. And in his narrative, he describes how he simply walked right through the encampment of the Confederate Army guarding Mobile. It was a garrison of about 10,000 Southern troops. They had built huge fortifications around the whole southwest exterior of Mobile, and he no doubt was simply mistaken for yet another black campaign. And then the rest of his narrative is this dramatic story of his three-week trek down the western shore of Mobile Bay for about 25 miles through the snake and alligator-infested swamps of what is today called the Fowl River Estuary, to where he finally reached the tip of land out at the mouth of Mobile Bay. And one day, this suffering, half-starved kid, he's now 17 years old, described how the tide brought in an old rowboat. And he said he simply got into the rowboat, took a plank of wood, and he rowed himself out into Mobile Bay, which it really is the ocean. And there comes this dramatic moment he describes where he says a wave was about to swamp his little boat. And he says he heard oars, and the oars he heard were those of a Union gunboat. And the Union gunboat pulled up next to him and said, "Jump in," and he jumps in. And then there's this remarkable moment in the text where he says, "I jumped into the Yankee's gunboat, and as I sat down, the Yankee sailors looked at me and were stunned with silence." And, of course, I can't prove whether that happened, but it did ring true to me, because here was this half-clothed, half-starved teenager in a rowboat in the ocean, risking everything for his own liberty. And those sailors indeed must have been stunned. They then took him to a sandbar island fort and clothed him and fed him. And the next day they rowed him out to Dauphin Island, which is the big sandbar island at the mouth of Mobile Bay. And there in Fort Gaines, the beautiful old ruins of which are still there, somewhere in that courtyard, he was interrogated by General Gordon Granger, who was the Union commander of all forces in that Mobile Gulf region. And he was probably interviewed because they wanted intelligence from Mobile. And General Granger gave Turnage two choices. One was to join a black regiment, and the second choice was to become a servant to a white officer. And Turnage chose the latter. And he then served out the rest of the war as a mess cook for a captain in a Maryland regiment whose name was Junius Turner. And Wallace Turnage's narrative frustratingly ends with 1865. He's with the Union forces when they captured Mobile, and then he traveled back across the country and was mustered out with that regiment in the summer of 1865 in Baltimore, Maryland. Turnage then lived out most of the rest of his life, remarkably, in New York City, where he will marry three times. Two wives will die on him. He'll have seven children, only three of whom live to adulthood. And he worked at about every kind of common labor job or occupation you could imagine until his death in 1916. And he is buried today in the collective burial plot of a black fraternal order that he joined. And he's buried in Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York.
It is so wonderful that the details these two men provided in their accounts allowed you to uncover what happened to them after the war.
Well, they did leave a lot of detail in their text, but the truth is, especially in Wallace Turnage's case, we had very little to go on. I say we because I had a remarkably talented research assistant, a great genealogist from the New York Public Library who helped me. In Wallace Turnage's case, we had to find him and the same is true of John Washington, but we had to find them after the war in census manuscripts, city directories, church records, bank records, newspapers, and a host of other kinds of obscure documents. But I was able to uncover where they live, their occupations, their churches, their children, what the children did, where they went to school, and so forth, in order to at least tell their stories. And what, in effect, I was able to do, I think, is to write a kind of dual biography of two heretofore unknown and ordinary former American slaves who become free men in the Civil War and live out long lives, struggling lives, difficult lives, but interesting lives nonetheless.
What were the lives of their children like and subsequent generations?
Well, that is remarkable. John and Annie Washington had five sons in Washington, D.C. They actually had six. One of them died in infancy. And what is clear is that John Washington passed on to his sons a value of education, a value about literacy, because at least two of his five sons attained a remarkable education, especially his youngest son named Benjamin, who went to M Street High School in Washington, which was the most prominent and sought after black high school. Benjamin attended summer school at Harvard University, and he became a science teacher at what's known as Armstrong Academy in Washington, D.C. for some 40 years. Armstrong Academy is, by the way, still there. And it was Benjamin's daughter, Evelyn Washington Easterly, who actually preserved her grandfather's manuscript, this narrative, and some adjoining documents, thank God, through time that enabled that manuscript to end up in my lap in the 21st century. In the case of Wallace Turnage, as I said, he had seven children, only three of whom lived to adulthood. And his children really struggled from what we were able to learn about them. But it was his one surviving daughter, Lydia Turnage Connolly, who preserved her father's manuscript. And this was, in some ways, the most stunning part of the research. She lived to be 99 years old. She married an Irish immigrant hotel worker in the 1940s named Thomas Connolly, and with him moved to Greenwich, Connecticut, where they both worked as servants in a hotel. And she outlived her husband. She lived to be 99 and died in 1984 in a nursing home. And when she died, she left only a couple boxes of effects to a neighbor lady, her only surviving friend, Gladys Watts, who is actually still alive. And Mrs. Watts sat on those boxes, or preserved them, for some 18 years until 2003, when she watched a PBS television documentary called Unchained Memories, which is about the WPA oral history narratives of the 1930s. And it was right after watching that film that she called up the Greenwich Historical Society and said, "I may have something that will interest you." And indeed she did, because in one of those boxes, in a black clamshell, a beautifully prepared black clamshell box, Lydia Turnage Connolly had preserved her father's narrative. It was almost as if she was hiding it. The only other thing in the box, and the only thing we had to go on to start with, were five beautiful photographs. Four of them of Wallace Turnage himself, and they're all in the book, all of them taken in studios at different stages of his life in the late 19th century. And then one photograph of Lydia herself when she was about 18 years old. This is what we had to start with on Wallace Turnage, but it was enough, at least, to begin the search to uncover the rest of his life.
With the act of writing their stories down and the act of children keeping these stories, what does this say about writing and keeping?
Oh, it's a great question, Celeste. It tells us that in this case, surely, there was a will to be known as the will to write. There was a desire to have people know who they were. And I have really struggled with this question about why each of these men wrote their narratives, because they don't tell us. There's no document that reveals exactly why they wrote them. So I have to speculate in the book. And the speculations I suggest are that, by and large, they may have written them essentially for their own children. John Washington writes his in 1873. We know that because he dates it. And that was the year that his fifth and final son was born. So he had sons at that point from age 1 to 11. Now, it's entirely possible that he simply wanted those sons to know, this is who your father is. This is where I'm from. This is what slavery was. You were all born in freedom. You don't know Virginia. Let me tell you who I am and where I and you are from. In Turnage's case, I really don't know exactly why he wrote, but I suspect similar reasons. He wanted those children to know who he was. He wanted somebody to know this terrible, dramatic, brutal story of his attempts to escape and all the beatings and the maltreatment that he had suffered in Alabama and Mississippi in 1861, 62, 63. And it's also entirely possible that in the United States of the 1880s, 1870s, 80s, and 90s, this era in which the Civil War veteran is being honored all over the country on both sides, and they're beginning to have all these blue-gray reunions of troops, about which I wrote at length in an earlier book, In that environment, a former slave, unknown, may have just wanted to say, hey, I have a story too. I have a tale to tell. Here's the most important moment in my life, and I'm going to write it down, hopefully, for somebody to read. There's no evidence that either of them ever tried to publish their narratives. If they did, it's not easy to find out, and it wouldn't have been that easy for them to get it published. In fact, that's one of the things that makes these two manuscripts, these two narratives, so remarkable, and that is that they were never touched by any publication process or any of the filtering process of editing. They arrived in my lap in the kind of beautifully creative grammar and broken spelling of two men who struggled with inadequate education, but nevertheless were able to write their story. They had a sense of metaphor, a sense of plot, a sense of beginning, middle, and end, and they had a sense of story.
Historian David Blight is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, including their own narratives of emancipation, the narratives written by John Washington and Wallace Turnage. We have a listener who would like to join us this afternoon, waiting on line one. Let's go to that call now. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I sure appreciate how interesting this is. I thank your guest for being here. I'm fascinated by this story, and I'm curious, did either of these men say in their journal or diary, did they say under what conditions they learned to read and write?
Yes, ma'am, they did. It's a great question. Both of them tell us in their narratives that they were first taught their alphabet and letters by their mothers, which is remarkable because of what we know about slave literacy in the 1840s and 1850s. Now, it was not that unusual for slaves to be literate in a town or a city, and John Washington had the good fortune of growing up in a town. He was an urban slave. Wallace Turnage, on the other hand, grew up, at least till the age of 13 and 14, on this small tobacco farm in Greene County, North Carolina. The fact that his mother was literate enough to teach him his first alphabet is quite remarkable. But that's where they first learned their letters. Now, in John Washington's case, he also tells us that he had some tutoring from one of his uncles. He also had some tutoring from a white minister. He also had access to newspapers and magazines. He even tells us that he at times read Harper's Monthly. In Turnage's case, there's less to go on as to exactly how he came to be able to write. It's likely that in New York City by the late 1860s into the 1870s and 80s, through his church, possibly through the fraternal order that he belonged to, that he gained a greater degree of literacy, certainly enough to write that narrative. But that's how they came by literacy first, which was from their mothers.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the question. Talk with us a little bit about the relationship between these men and their mothers. And one of the heartbreaking moments in Washington's account is Christmas of 1850.
Oh, indeed. He calls that little chapter, the title he gives it is Left Alone. It's this parting with his mother. He's about 12 years old, 11
yeah.
years old. And his mother and his four siblings are being hired out. They were hired out from Fredericksburg out to Western Virginia, Stanton, Virginia. And he's left behind as the personal servant of his mistress. And it's this heart-rending breakup of mother and son, which, by the way, is a very common story in almost all male slave narratives, that moment when they last saw their mothers, or they thought they were going to last see their mothers. But what is remarkable in John Washington's case, beyond that particular dramatic scene, is that he wrote letters to and from his mother. One of the reasons he kept working on his literacy, by the way, he tells us this, is so he could get better at writing letters to his mother. And we know they exchanged letters because he tells us that. We also have one surviving letter that John Washington wrote from 1858. That letter happens to be a love letter that he wrote to his childhood sweetheart, who he later married. In Wallace Turnage's case, he too was very close to his mother. In fact, he tells us even when he's escaping in Mississippi, when he would be captured and people would ask him, where are you going? Where are you running? He would say, I want to go home. I want to go home. And home to this 15-year-old at that point could only have meant North Carolina and probably, you know, to the environment of his mother. And then I must tell you that after the war was over, and during the 3 years he lived in Baltimore from 1865 to 68, at some point in those 3 years, he went back to North Carolina, and he retrieved his mother and his four half-siblings because they all turn up in a census manuscript document living in the 300 block of Thompson Street in what we call Greenwich Village in New York City today. In the 1870 census, they were all living in the same tenement building. And his mother lived in New York. He brought her there. Whatever meager wages he could earn, he must have kept trying to support her, because his mother, Courtney Hart, died in 1890 in New York City, living in the 200 block of West 60th Street, which is today right behind what New Yorkers know as Lincoln Center. These men were very close to their mothers. They not only never abandoned their mothers, but they went to great risks to retrieve them and bring them into their lives once they were in a world of freedom.
Hmm. Any surviving descendants?
There are indeed. In fact, after the book was finished and just before it was published, we always knew, I should back up, we always knew there wouldn't likely be any Turnage descendants because his three surviving children died childless. But we did know that some of John Washington's surviving children had children. John Washington Jr. indeed had three daughters. And through continuing to search in records and especially in obituaries, we found an obituary last summer, June of last summer, 2007, in New Jersey, that listed a Ruth Washington. And we knew that John Washington Jr. had a daughter named Ruth, and we connected her to the cousin who had died. And sure enough, it said Ruth Washington, Tampa, Florida. And after a good deal of phone calling, we found her. We found the 89-year-old Ruth Washington, the direct descendant, granddaughter of John Washington. She lives today in a trailer park retirement village in Tampa, Florida. And I had the unforgettable experience last October of calling her up to tell her I was about to publish her grandfather's narrative. And the stunning thing about that was that Ruth knew nothing about her grandfather. She knew that she had had a grandfather and a grandmother, but she had never met them. He died the year she was born. Her father, John Jr., then died when she was only 18, and she tells me that her father never talked about the past. They were instructed never to look backward. He was a stable, working-class guy, her father. Worked in a meat packing factory in Jersey City, New Jersey. Bought his own home. Was going to get his daughters educated, and indeed, Ruth was a freshman at Hampton University in Virginia when her father died, not even knowing that her people came from Virginia. And just to round that story out, last November, I brought Ruth, her daughter, and her granddaughter up to Fredericksburg, Virginia, and we held an extraordinary event on a Saturday night in the Old Baptist Church of Fredericksburg, where John Washington himself had been baptized. The National Park Service helped me put it on. And we ended the whole evening with Ruth Washington, this 89-year-old woman, extraordinarily eloquent and articulate. She got up at the pulpit and delivered a handwritten 15-minute speech on what it meant to discover her slave ancestry and to discover that she was a descendant of Fredericksburg, Virginia. So I guess the point of all that is never say never. In the search for records, genealogical or otherwise, and never say never about not being able to find descendants. Ruth and her family have embraced this story fully, and I'm going to make them part of the epilogue when we put the paper back out next year.
Well, what a moment that must have been.
It was an extraordinary moment when I first met them. I flew to Tampa to meet them all, and they picked me up at the airport with the 89-year-old Ruth Washington at the wheel of the car.
How wonderful.
And she took me to her favorite restaurant, which was the Cheesecake Factory out at the mall. And we sat for about 5 or 6 hours at that restaurant sharing photographs and documents and stories. And as a historian, I can tell you I have never had an experience quite like that.
Well, there we have to leave it. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you and to hear you tell these stories. David Blight, thank you very much, Celeste.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. David Blight is the author of A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, the narratives of Wallace Turnage and John Washington. The book is published by Harcourt, and I know that it will be wonderful to read the epilogue in the paperback edition, but I would say go out and get A Slave No More in hardback.